ようこそどうぞはじめまして。
Hello everyone, welcome to the Glorio Chat, the most consistent anime podcast on the internet.
Something like that.
Sure.
Better than our last efforts, yeah. At least.
Infinitely more consistent than previously.
Well, at some point, I'll be able to introduce the pod without having to pat myself on the back for actually making a podcast, but maybe we're not there yet. But yeah, we're glad to be back. I'm your host, Jel, the Supreme Emperor of theglorioblog.com. With me today, I have, of course, our other members of the Glorio crew. I have Iroh.
Hi.
We have G-Man.
Yo, yo. You could just call me also the savior of this week's podcast. So,
wow, that's bold claims right off the bat. We have a special episode this week because we are joined by Zig.
I wouldn't say anything is saved until we're done here, quite frankly.
Look, I'm just saying, I saved y'all at least, according to this recording, 90 seconds. So.
Gee, we don't talk about the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Yeah, pulling back the curtain a little too far.
We're a professional podcast, clearly. I did not forget to hit the recording button.
Recording and, like, not even press the record button or anything.
Yeah, I did not forget to push the record button 5 minutes ago. But yes, we are glad to be back here for another episode of the Glorio Chat. We don't have a super focused topic this week. We just kind of wanted to catch up on some of the shows we're watching. 2 weeks back, we did talk about Violet Evergarden and Darling in the Franxx, so we're going to touch base with where we're at with those. And there are a couple other shows I wanted to talk about. I wanted to start with Mr. Osomatsu, which we're in the second quarter of season two, and I feel like the show has been kind of flying under the radar, even though it's been really good, I think, the past couple episodes.
Definitely compared to, like, how popular season one was.
Yeah, and I think that's just getting comfortable with it, maybe, as you know, as it goes on and they kind of, you know, keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, it's a known quantity. You know, part of the appeal of season one was that it was this very unexpected, transgressive thing, you know, that appeared out of nowhere and, and was, you know, very crude and rude and very unlike traditional anime comedy. And I mean, like, for better or worse, it's now something we've come to expect from that show, and therefore I don't think there's quite as much buzz surrounding
it. Yeah, it's a show that got attention for kind of surprising us, and it's getting a little harder to surprise us, maybe.
I think that's why I personally have kind of fallen off the Osomatsu bandwagon. I'm like, I started the season, but I am like a good, like, 6-7 episodes behind at this point. And it's not to say that this season hasn't been funny, but I think at least for me, it's the task that all comedy sequels are given, right? It's the unenviable task of trying to be bigger and better and badder than the predecessor, and it doesn't always quite work out.
I mean, I'd broadly agree with you there, G. I mean, for me, Osomatsu was always a very inconsistent show. You know, when it's funny, it's extremely funny. When it's not funny, it can be kind of a drag. And I feel like this second season in particular, they front-loaded an awful lot of the best comedy. Like, those first couple of episodes, especially episode one, are extremely strong and very, very funny. And I feel like there has been sort of a gradual but noticeable drop-off since then, you know, like, I haven't enjoyed most of the episodes through the teens, or at least I haven't found them, you know, rolling in the aisles funny like I did the first couple.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It certainly hasn't been quite as entertaining in the second season, but I did want to talk about it now because of the latest episode, episode 18, which, just to give a little brief synopsis, it's based on a chapter from the manga, which is also based on the classic Charlie Chaplin movie, City Lights. And it's one of those episodes that the series throws out every now and then where it's kind of more emotionally heavy, a little more serious, and you're kind of waiting for the punchline, and just never, there's no punchline. They're just pretty much play it straight. I think the most classic example that people would think of is like the Jushimatsu Falls in Love episode, where it just ends up having an actual serious kind of sweet ending to it. And no, I was just going to say,
go on.
Personally, I love that kind of thing where they kind of mix the silly and the serious stuff, but I know you guys have different opinions on that sometimes. So I'm going to throw it to you guys and maybe see what you thought of episode 18.
I mean, just for context, I've seen City Lights. Has anybody else seen that movie?
I have not.
I think I saw it when I was like really little, but I barely remember. I kind of know the gist of it, but yeah.
I mean, it is a black and white silent movie from the 30s. You know, it is not exactly the kind of thing that is widely circulated. I think it's a very interesting choice to homage in an episode, and it shows what we kind of already knew, which is that Studio Pierrot are very versed in Western media and Western film and pop culture and stuff like that. And I don't think it's a reference that many people, let alone many Japanese people, would get. So from that point, it's interesting in that it shows Pierrot's appreciation of the world beyond anime. And I always appreciate it when writers and studios and animators can kind of go beyond the small reference pool that anime normally does and strike out to something a little bit more worldly, so to speak. So I liked that aspect of it, definitely.
I haven't seen the episode, but you said it was based off of a manga, which was in itself also inspired by City Lights. Is that manga super popular?
The original Osomatsu manga.
Okay, okay.
I think from what I understand, the anime most of the time is not based on the manga, because we're talking like from 1966 or whatever. So there was a chapter with the same title. I think it's Iami Alone in the Wind. Was that the title?
Yes, that's it.
And I actually looked up the manga chapter, and it was actually set in the Edo period, and like Iami was, you know, he meets the blind girl and he decides to be a samurai or something. So it was a little bit different. Kind of the same general idea where he's this, you know, drifter bum guy that cleans up his life to, you know, help this little girl. And that's kind of like the chain of, you know, inspiration for this episode, which moves it kind of the post-war 1950s Showa era Japan instead of the Edo period.
And,
yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that the period they chose is one of the most interesting things about it, to be honest, actually, because you don't see in anime a representation of the post-war period of Japan much, at least not in television anime. And it's a fascinating time period for so many reasons. And of course, it's quite a good parallel with the original film, which was, of course, set in the Great Depression. It was released in 1931 and was set at a contemporary period. So, I think it was really interesting that they chose that period and, like, subtly added trappings and little bits of background detail to establish that that was the time. You know, it's a good match if you're going to transpose that story forward.
Yeah, see, this is why you guys had to watch Rakugo when I told you all to watch it. It has Showa in the title.
Hey, I watched it.
Ira watched it. So he understands. So that was covering that time period.
Yes.
But
yes, you know, but I feel the point still stands as, like, generally it's not a period that anime visits a great deal.
Sure.
You know, there are exceptions to everything, of course. You know, but generally if anime is going to go back to a time, it either goes way, way back into, like, feudal history or to the 70s or 80s, you know, much more stylistically ambitious periods, let's say.
I'm not saying, I wouldn't say it's common, but at the same time, I feel like the Showa era flashback is almost a parody at this point in certain anime and manga. Like, there are at least a couple manga off the top of my head. The one that comes to mind right now is Hajime no Ippo, but I feel like actually a surprising number of manga and anime have the, like, let's look into the backstory of, like, this grizzled old man character in our main cast, and inevitably it is, like, some Showa period post-war, you know, romantic tragedy or something, but...
I guess, you know, it's just something that I haven't seen much in anime, and that may speak more to my taste in anime and the kind of thing I seek out instead. But I found it refreshing, to say the least.
Yeah, and as I was saying, you know, I really love when they mix the kind of silly and serious stuff. It's what, you know, I absolutely love. I always rave about on the site, the director, Yuichi Fujita. You know, shout out to Bimbogami Ga and the first season of Classicaloid. But,
a very skilled man.
Yeah,
he definitely is.
But only the first season.
Yeah, only the first season of Classicaloid. But yeah, it's something I think he does very well. And, you know, I loved some of the things he did in this episode, like the way he kind of like handled the color stuff, where it was kind of like all sepia for most of it. And then it kind of introduced the color toward the end. Yeah, I just think he's really, really great at that kind of thing. And, you know, I really love that. But I don't know, where would you guys put this on the pantheon of best Osamatsu episodes?
I mean, I'll go first, because I feel like I was one of the people of our group who very much didn't really see what the fuss about Jushimatsu in Love was. You know, it's an interesting, fun little diversion from the main part of the show, but I always thought that it was severely overrated. You know, you heard stuff about how it made people cry, and I could never buy
that.
Man,
really?
You know, I could never buy that. And
I liked, I guess that's the thing, actually. It's funny you say that, because I'm actually kind of in that camp as well. Like, I thought the Jushimatsu in Love episode was really neat, but not like, it's, I guess it's not necessarily what I come to comedy for. Like, I don't mind comedy having some heart, but sometimes it feels like to me that that heart is not necessarily earned.
I'd agree with that. Yeah, I mean, the issue I had with it, and I have to a lesser extent with this, I think I liked this generally more than Jushimatsu in Love, is that it's not an organic outreach of the show. You know, it is the show temporarily becoming a completely different show, and that would be fine if it was explicitly part of, you know, part of the show's modus operandi, but it just sort of moves into another genre completely at random, and we're forced to like take these characters seriously who we've previously seen like farting and killing each other and like squabbling.
All 100% accurate, right. All 100% accurate and literal there. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I feel like this works better because it's not such a radical shift. You know, like, there are elements of the E-Army we know in there, and there's still a lightly comic tone running through the whole thing, like E-Army's attempt to, like, wrestle his way to riches, and he puts the Shay hold on the guy and stuff. So I feel like this worked better because it's whimsical in tone. There's also the issue that since the original film came out in 1931, the blind flower girl thing has become such a cliche that it's kind of difficult to take it seriously anymore. So I appreciate the fact that they stretched their wings a bit and tried something different. And I'll always go to bat for somebody making something in black and white in this day and age. But it was a pleasant diversion, which I don't necessarily think needed an entire episode devoted to it, is where I'll stand on that.
Ira, where are you at? Are we putting this over Super Iami Kart 64?
No, I don't think so. I like, as I said, since it's Osamatsu's like chiefly a comedy, it's always a little bit jarring to get like the more serious episodes. And while I think it can work, it's like we were talking about how season two just can't surprise us as much, right? And so I find like starting the episode, I think to myself, oh, it's another one of those like serious bits. And while even though it's done well, like it doesn't have the same kind of impact that it might have in the first season, like with Jushimatsu in Love.
Yeah, or it kind of came out of nowhere. I think with... Go ahead, right.
I mean, I think my other issue is that I feel like it's possible to organically develop character and emotion and like moments of great sadness and joy through comedy writing. It's possible to take those characters and not necessarily have to displace them in time and personality. Like, I always refer back to the original final episode of Futurama for, like, a great example of how you can take a completely outlandish premise and ridiculous characters, but you can generate genuine emotion and attachment to them, and then have them have it pay off in a fashion that is both sincere but also true to the spirit of the majority of the cartoon.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with that. I think, or something like that with, you know, right, yes, like Futurama is a great example. I think, personally, I know this is contentious, I think another example for me would be Nichijou, actually, as like an example, yes, of like, you can totally make something heartfelt, but still like feel in character, because even if it is primarily a comedy, these are still the characters you have, like, not grown up with, but like you have watched them grow throughout the run of the show. So like when they have like a, you know, heartfelt serious moment, it's not necessarily like, you know, it's not like they earned it in the sense of like, oh, they went through these trials and tribulations, but also like you're familiar with these characters, you know who they are, you know like what they like, what they hate, and so like them having those moments can totally work within the context of the show and its story.
And I think, you know, I think some of the emotional impact of this is dulled by the fact that we have seen E-Army, you know, like eating cardboard and like sleeping on the street. And, you know, in the previous episode, he was mauled to death, right, by a giant Yeti. You know, it's very difficult to reconcile that character with like the shady but fundamentally good guy he is in this story, when the entire point of the character in every other depiction, including in the original manga and original anime, Osamatsu-kun, is that he's just the worst person in the entire universe. You know, that he is this super shady, super sketchy character. And I think
the dirtiest dirtbag.
And I think that does detract some of the power from this episode. Like, Jushimatsu in Love works because Jushimatsu is fundamentally the least malicious of the Matsunos, and it sort of has that dumb puppy love, he doesn't know better stuff to it, whereas this is a much more dramatic personality shift for E-Army, even if he does start as kind of like a lazy stealing scumbag.
I think that's all, those are all valid points. The only counterpoint I would throw up in Osamatsu's case is they've kind of built it as a show where at this point, literally like anything can happen in any self-contained story, especially in season three.
Right.
Especially in
we can jump to like, yeah, Caveman Matsus, where, okay, they're all just characters playing roles now.
Or they're all girls this time or whatever. So I think the context is there for just like this totally random standalone story where you can reimagine the character as something slightly different. But I get what, I mean, I think the rest of it is all very valid where you can do that, but then maybe it's not going to have as much of an emotional impact when you do it.
I mean, I was intrigued and charmed by what happened, but it doesn't change the fact that I ultimately come to Osumatsu for like the three or four times in the 26 odd episodes that they just put together a scorchingly funny premise, and that's the draw of the show to me, you know, when they go big on the insanity, big on the silliness and stuff. And I think especially this season, you know, there are so many good shows which are about tugging the heartstrings and character focused drama and comedy that it definitely feels a little bit more out of place than perhaps Jushimatsu in Love did.
Sure. Just one final note. Is it safe to throw out a mild Yakuza 0 spoiler?
You put out a warning.
I'm just going to say that Yami made me think of Majima in this episode. You can all, anybody that's played Yakuza 0 to completion, and just think about that the next time you see Yami on screen. And why he is the way that.
See, when you put it like that, that's what makes me go like,
you gotta watch the episode.
You
gotta
watch
that episode.
I think we'll
leave it on there. I don't want to. Everybody just play Yakuza 0 anyway because it's an amazing game. And
yes, that's
we'll leave it at that. All right.
You see, regular Iyami reminds me a lot more of Majima in Yakuza Kiwami, where he just pops up out of dustbins and from round corners and dressed up as policemen.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying, Zig. Which, if you play Zero, you'll understand. But yes. All right, so let's leave the Osamatsu there. Good episode, I think we can all agree. And we'll go on to the next show I wanted to talk about. And this is one that I am not really familiar with, but you guys have been loving it for the past couple years. And there's I'm talking about Garo. And what is the current series called?
Garo Vanishing Line.
Okay. So currently airing is Garo Vanishing Line. And I know the only thing I know is it's based off of a long running live action series of some kind. And there was an anime a couple years ago that you guys loved. That's pretty much all I know. So maybe somebody can give me a quick rundown of some kind of context on what Garo is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the first tokusatsu guy here, so I'll talk a little bit about it. Garo was basically originally a live action, tokusatsu means live action men in rubber suits thing, and that's what Garo originally was, you know. It was, the whole shtick was originally that it was kind of a darker, edgier counterpart to traditional tokusatsu like Kamen Rider or Super Sentai, Power Rangers, which are, you know, definitely Saturday morning viewing for kids. So the original live-action Garo is kind of like completely melodramatic in a My Chemical Romance kind of way. And, you know, there's lots of naked ladies and bad CGI blood and stabbing people and monsters who are almost inevitably naked ladies. And you get the idea, you know. So, like, it is very entertaining garbage. And that's mostly what these TV series have been, these animated TV series have been, too. So there have been three Garo anime so far. The first one, The Carved Seal of Flames, was set in Europe, quote unquote. It's probably Spain, but who knows? Like in medieval times, and was basically like a very effective, fun fantasy serial potboiler. Effectively, lots and lots of, you know,
and had a really good sequel movie.
Yes, had an excellent sequel movie directed by the series director for this show. But yeah, it was all medieval themed. You know, lots and lots of, you know, busty peasants and evil viziers, good kings and princes and all that kind of stuff. And then there was a sequel, Garo Crimson Moon, which transposed the whole concept to feudal Japan. Definitely not an overused and stale setting at this point. And it was awful. Absolutely appalling.
Right.
Completely without the spirit. Or the, you know, the fire, the verve, the snappy dialogue of the original. Just an endless drone of bad writing and bad characters.
It looked like shit.
That's the thing, right? Right, like, that's the thing, right? It's like, it's not only, like, it's a sequel in all, but, I mean, it's a sequel theoretically, but, like, it didn't even have the same staff, right?
Yes. And I should point out that the whole concept of Garo follows the thing that most tokusatsu series go, which is the series are barely related to each other beyond the basic premise that there is a knight in golden armor called Garo. This was true for the live action series as well, and it's true for these animated ones. So this third series now, Vanishing Line, is set in present day quote unquote America, or a very American.
Oh man,
it is a.
It's a version of many things.
It is, you know, a version of America.
Or the rolling plains of the American Midwest.
And then there's,
you know, the apocalyptic West Coast.
Yeah, so like this, we were a little...
I mean, that sounds pretty accurate to me, but, you know.
We were a little bit nervous about this one because the last Garo show was so bad. But this one, they've rediscovered what made the first one good, which was, you know, this very pulp comic book sensibility. Lots of big, silly fights. Some broad but good characterization. You know, it's not deep, it's not particularly meaningful, but they do a good job of sketching out some good characters with strong motivations and good looks and personalities about them, you know. And they've done a great job of building up this weird, fake America with lots and lots of classic American cliches like road trips and a visit to fake Cuba and all this sort of stuff. And it's just good, honest, kind of sleazy fun, you know. And it's definitely not for everybody, you know. It has some issues. Like most anime, it's not particularly kind to its female characters. But it definitely recaptures the kind of like pulp 1930s serial feel that the first Garo anime had, and for that reason it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. That's my overwhelming impression of it.
Also in the first episode, the main character summons his super armor by doing sick donuts with his motorcycle.
Yeah. There's that.
So,
oh man.
Anime of the year 2018. Like
I heard something about punching a bullet.
He punched a bullet.
So in the episode a couple weeks ago, where they're in fake Mexico / fake Cuba, and main character Sword, his name is Sword.
Oh, right, I forgot to mention that.
Gets like what? Gets like involved in gang violence, basically, and someone shoots at him, and he just punches the bullet in slow mo with his fist. And sent it flying into a car.
Yo, he punched that fucking bullet.
Yeah. I mean, I'll point out as well that, like, the show is clearly made on a limited budget, let's say. But when they bring it for the fight scenes, they really bring it. Like, there is a lot of extremely fluid, very over-the-top animation that happens. You know, some really stylish camera work and just... they go flying around, destroying skyscrapers. It's all that stuff, you know, the kind of thing that live-action tokusatsu attempts but never quite pulls off because it has the budget of a small frying pan. But they really do go all out, balls to the wall.
Yeah,
and it's impressive when they do.
I think, like, for me personally, like, as someone who has probably, like, voiced, you know, their grievances with, like, the heavy use of CG in a lot of anime, I would say that Garo is actually one of the examples that actually manages to pull off its use of CG that is thematically appropriate and uses its medium strengths in a way that I think a lot of anime struggle with. Like, it's kind of like what Zig was saying, like, Garo's fights are, like, crazy and wild and fluid, and, like, they do crazy camera shifts that you could only accomplish with CG. And you can tell that the people who are working on that show, like, really lean into the strengths of CG as a medium, and makes Garo's fights work so much better than a lot of other anime that rely heavily on CG.
It's worth pointing out that as we said before, the director of this series, Song Ho Park, directed the Garo.
Steve was like animation director in the film.
Oh, sorry,
not the main director.
Yeah, he was the animation director for the Divine Flame movie, which was a sequel to the first series. And that film used CG incredibly well to depict horses power sliding on water. So,
in many ways, watching that movie, you could kind of see where his mindset went towards giving Sword a motorcycle and vanishing line.
Yeah, it's...
You see the logical connection there.
To me, like, Vanishing Line feels a lot like a throwback to, like, the way we saw anime in the early to mid-90s, you know? It's very heavy urban fantasy. It's full of, like, guns, gore, and boobs, and that slight edge of weird, strange pulpiness that a lot of 80s and 90s anime seemed to us in the West. You know, it's a hell of a thing, and like I said, I don't think it's perfect, but it is definitely a lot of fun, and that's enough to make it worth watching.
No, but I think it should be praised, because, like, if you were to describe Garo to me, like, in its most, like, at its most fundamental, like, reductive level, Garo sounds like the worst fucking thing on the planet. Like, it's like, oh, it's Kamen Rider, but it's bloody and there's sex and violence. You know, it by all accounts, it should sound like the worst thing ever. But I think, again, having not watched the you know, the live action stuff, I don't know if this applies to that as well. But at least for the anime, I think Garo employs just enough self awareness to make it work in a way that doesn't feel too up its own ass or end up taking itself too self-seriously.
I mean, the fundamental thing it shares with the live action series is that it understands the concept of camp. You know, it is very camp.
Sure,
and
totally.
Very stylized rubbish. And that's extremely entertaining. And it's not necessarily, it's a kind of self-awareness that does not take the form of like a wink at the audience and a nudge in the ribs at like, hey, look at how rubbish this all is. You know, it understands that and it uses it to its strength without ever breaking the facade of its own storytelling world. You know, and in that way, it's a compelling story as well as being very silly and very over the top.
That's a hard thing to do, really. It sounds
absolutely,
yeah.
It's a tough balance, and I mean, that's personally like, yes, in some ways it is just, you know, it is the campiest trash, but in a lot of ways, like I genuinely like want to fight for Garo for 2018 for a lot of reasons, because I think it deserves to be praised for managing that balance so effectively, because I think a lot of shows try it and they either, you know, it's kind of like what you were saying, Zeke, they either lean too heavy in one direction where, you know, the main character is winking directly at the camera, or they go too far in the other direction where it's too self-serious and you're laughing at it rather than with it. And I think Garo does a really effective job of striking that balance.
Yeah, I think that's a very good summary of why we enjoy it so much.
Also, yo, he punched that bullet.
He punched the bullet, so that's pretty cool. I know it doesn't sound like the type of show I would personally like, or at least not something I would want to watch every from week to week, but I mean, it does sound like a lot of fun, and I know you guys really love watching it, so it sounds like something worth checking out if that's your thing. For sure. All right, let's keep it rolling here because we have a couple other shows we want to cover. We mentioned earlier we wanted to touch base with Violet Evergarden and Darling in the Franxx and catch up with our discussion on that. So we've already got the size coming in.
Why did we start with our dessert and then finish off with our vegetables?
What's been done has been done. Let's take our medicine here. And let's talk about Violet Evergarden first. So,
ain't no fucking way she's 14.
Yeah. So let's start with that.
Dude, what the fuck?
The most obvious thing that caught our attention this past episode. At some point, Violet reveals that she says that she's an orphan. So she doesn't really know for sure, but she's told that she's 14 years old. Now, let me just say before we get into that. They have said many times they basically called her a child. So I always assumed she was in the magical anime 15 to 17 age. I don't know if 14 is really that much different, but yeah, it's pretty young. So,
well, the character design makes her look like 24, 25 to me.
Right. Like, I think the problem is that Violet looks young because all anime characters look young, but she's designed in a way that, at least to me, is supposed to read as older.
Displays adult threat.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying, like, look, the way anime designs like 24-year-olds as like basically one foot in the grave already. Like, I know she wasn't going to be like that old, but like, I was expecting like that nebulous like anime 16 to 20, I guess.
Right.
I'm just kind of upset that every anime show has to be about teenagers. You know, like
that's nothing new. So
no, not at all. You know, but like, I did not personally enjoy Violet Evergarden or the beginning of Violet Evergarden, which I saw, but it at least seemed like a sincere attempt to tell a story about the aftermath of war, which is a worthy subject for a story. You know, and
I wish it did.
I wish. Yeah.
And I feel like this is just a symptom. And again, I can't comment because I've not seen too much of the show, but this just seems to be a symptom of making it as anime as possible. You know, you need to sell those PVC figures, right? So,
like, the corollary of her being 14 is that it changes from child soldier, human weapon to like, killer psycho child, right? As opposed to like killer psycho teen. Which,
and I think it also, at least to me, like for my own sense of immersion, it's like it's that thing of like writers having no sense of time or scale. So like if she's a veteran of this like nebulous World War One setting and she's 14 now, that means she must have been like 10 when she was a soldier, which it's as Iroh said, like it just puts everything into a weird light.
Yeah, so her age, 14, kind of bleeds into the content of episode 5. So the reason why it came up is she was asked by her client, who is also 14 years old and is the princess of some neighboring nation or whatever, and she basically is contracted to write these love letters for this arranged marriage of this 14 year old who fell in love with this guy when she was 10. So
sure.
Kind of problematic at first glance.
Yeah. On the like the idea of royalty marrying off their daughters at 10 or 14 is within the bounds.
It's not
of,
unheard
like,
of.
Right. Like I see that and I go like, yeah, that makes sense. But the issue is A, presenting it as like true love or something, and B, the princess asking, is this okay? And Violet saying, yeah, it's totally cool.
Right, there's a part in this episode where Violet almost like gives a PSA, like looks directly into the camera and gives a speech about how age is just a number, and it is. I think it's the difference between.
I have researched
like,
many texts. I have found age is just a number. Beep boop.
Right, it's the difference between. A fact that is presented within the context of a show and what that fact implies on like the meta contextual level, right? Like within the show itself, a marriage between like a marriage between a 14-year-old and a 24-year-old is not game breaking, because like considering its weird like pseudo post World War One setting, that kind of makes it's believable. The problem is on the meta level.
It is, I think.
Yeah, totally.
In the not too
right, like that's
past.
The part that I honestly as a history buff, that's the part I don't really roll my eyes at. The part I roll my eyes at is like when Violet is giving this speech about like, nah, it's cool. Like, don't worry about it. Like, I read a ton of books. Like, what kind of books were you reading?
So I think we can, at the very least, compartmentalize that and chalk it up to. Anime age nonsense and kind of push that aside for the time being.
Apart from that, I would say this is the best episode yet, because it doesn't focus on the like ridiculous robot nature of Violet.
The problem with this being this show's best episode is that this episode technically does the things that I wanted Violet to ever garden the show itself to do, but it does it out of nowhere. It doesn't really earn it, you know, like because literally
like we
last week,
a
like
new show.
Yeah, like this episode feels like it was out of a completely different, better version of Violet Evergarden. You know, last week, like literally last week, we were still on the like,
I do not
beep
understand
boop, what are emotions thing. You know, like literally last week, and the only thing this week's episode does is say like. Gee, Violet, you've really been improving the last few months, and it's like,
let's trust this matter of national security to you.
Like, yo, show us those last. Like, why didn't you show us those last few months at the beginning of this show?
The like growth that she, the state she's in this episode compared to the state she was in one episode ago, has such a there's such a huge gulf between them that it doesn't feel earned to have her suddenly be at this at this point in her. Growth or whatever,
right? Like it sounds super like, or not petty, but like pedantic or something like that. I'm complaining about finally being given the version of Violet I want, but the journey matters too, you know. Like it's just disappointing, because watching this episode of Violet, you can see like now you can kind of see the version of Violet Evergarden that we all hoped it would have been from the very start, mm-hmm. but because it's this version of Violet 5 episodes in. Now I'm just not confident in where this show's going to go, because
right.
is next week's episode going to carry this momentum, or is she going to revert back to like comically robotic mode next week? I just don't have confidence in the show to go one way or the other anymore.
Yeah, I was just going to explain a little bit more what we're talking about as far as the change. Like in episode 4, it's what we've seen her up to that point of where she could barely write a sentence with an adjective and had like no feeling whatsoever. And then we skip ahead. I guess we skip ahead. Other than that one line G mentioned, that's all we get in episode 5. Because I watched them back to back, so it was like even more jarring
so did
like,
I.
watching them without a week break. The next episode, they're like, oh, I guess you're better now because it's months later. And then suddenly she's writing this like elaborate love letter and she's being trusted with this job. Like Hiro said, it's like, you know, national security on the line, basically. If this falls through, then the arranged marriage isn't going to happen. And so like there's just literally no progress in there whatsoever. It's just like flip a switch. Now she's and like even like the way she reacts to like the girl still thinks she's kind of cold or whatever, but you can see her like affected by the human emotion of it all and everything. And it's like, when did this happen? This just like happened out of nowhere. Like,
I think that's my problem is
we wanted it. Yeah. We wanted that to happen. And just, but we wanted to, if we're going to not start there in the first place, we want to see how we got there. You know,
needed to build up or anything. It needed, like the thing is that, I wouldn't want to push this specific episode even more back into this show's run because then my tolerance fades away every week. But last week's episode and maybe even the episode before that should have been the build up to this specific episode.
And not what they were instead.
We should have started to see. Yeah, like we should have started seeing like the cracks start to show. We should have started like. What we really needed, I think, was an episode where Violet is, in fact, is requested to write a letter, but not one of this level of magnitude.
Yeah.
I think if we had an episode, like, even last week, that was, you know, that was about Violet being tasked with writing a letter of maybe smaller scale, but her struggling with it, and then by the end of the episode, you know, making a breakthrough, then that makes this week's episode feel a lot more organic, I guess.
Yeah.
The first couple episodes, like we didn't really see her making progress up to episode 4. Like it was every week was kind of the same thing, where she still didn't quite understand, and it ended up kind of working out because, you know, at least she was being honest or whatever, and you know that felt like that's the way they were going, and you know where maybe her style was going to work out somehow, and you know we didn't see her making progress. It was the same thing every week. And then rather than, you know, they could have done that in, you know, episode 2, 3, and 4, where maybe she's getting a little better. And then if you want to do a little bit of a time skip, fine. But
right.
Yeah, there's just like nothing.
So my understanding is that the source material is very much like not as much about Violet, but it's like a collection of chapters about her clients who, you know, get their problems solved because she writes letters for them. And then they're like, oh, what a strange and mysterious girl that Violet Evergarden. But then, like, the original or the anime putting more focus on her means that, like, her character traits have to be kind of expanded into, you know, being the central plot. And I don't know if that was the best idea, considering.
I think there is a way to do Violet as the primary protagonist of this show. I just think Kiyoani's interpretation of her character, other than this week's episode, missed the mark.
Can I blame the director again?
What I'm hearing you all say is something I've felt in quite a few Kyoto Animation productions now, which is... they're very good at the micro level of storytelling, you know, of building scenes and individual encounters very well, but they don't seem to have much. Let me rephrase that. My impression is they don't have quite as much control over the macro level of the story. Like, I felt this with Love, Chunibyo, and Other Delusions, with K-On! Season 2. with some of Euphonium is that they kind of arrive at the end of their stories almost by accident. And there are, you get a bunch of great scenes and great characters and great moments, but there's not necessarily the structured build that you, that is necessary for like ramping up to a climax.
Well, I would say just with the previous examples, I think so. I think most of the source material they pick has been just garbage. they're kind of salvaging it to the best of their ability a lot of times. From what I understand, though, with Violet Evergarden, it might be the first time where it might be the other way around. This is complete speculation, but I think we've seen in some places that this most recent episode was actually based on the novels, where the previous ones were not.
Or structurally, anyway. I don't think it's direct adaptation of a chapter.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't want to say stuff that's not true, so maybe strike that from the record. But, you know, that is something that I think Kiwani has struggled with in the past, is, you know, they add a lot of their own stuff in there. And, you know, where are you pulling, you know, are you pulling good stuff and cutting bad stuff, or vice versa, or whatever? And, yeah, I don't know. Of course, then the other option is they do an original thing and we get Tomoko Market. So I don't know. There's a solution there.
Beyond the boundary.
Or beyond the boundary, yes.
Well, that was a light novel.
It was the same.
I never could have guessed that thing was a light novel.
And it's actually the same director as Violet Evergarden, which is his second major project, and that's what I was complaining about last time because I hate him. But all right, well, yeah, I think we agree that this is the version of Violet Evergarden that we wanted in the latest episode. Just
4 episodes late,
we could have found a better way. Could have found a better way to get here. Maybe it's a little too late. I guess that kind of gives us maybe some hope that it'll be good from here on. We still have like 9 episodes left. I think they're going full 14 for the season. So, you know, maybe things are looking up now. And I mean, this will just be a road bump. I don't know, but
it would be certainly nice if this episode is, you know, that's a thing, right? If at the end of the season we look back and we're like, oh yeah, you know, Violet finally got it together at episode 5 or whatever, then that's awesome. I guess the reason I'm still skeptical is because this episode was good for reasons entirely different from what this anime has been up till now. And I guess I would have to look at the staff listing to see if anything changed with this week's episode.
If things go back to
quote-unquote status quo next week, then that's only going to make this week's episode all the more tragic in hindsight.
Yeah, Iroh is mentioning they brought in Naoko Yamada, who's like the big Kiwani star director.
Sure.
But she, I think she did storyboards, which I don't want to downplay that, but I don't know if that's really what saved the episode.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't know. What the fuck are the other Kiwani directors doing right now? Where is the Nichijou director? Surely he could fix this, right?
He's probably making the third Love Chunibyo and Other Delusions movie or something like that. Yeah, so I don't know. They only do movies now. They do like one TV show a year and then they do like all movies. So who knows what they're up to. But all right. Well, hopefully things are looking up, but we'll see how that goes. Let's move on to, you know, one last show we want to talk about. Obviously, we mentioned Darling in the Franxx. I have to admit, I could not bring myself to watch more of this garbage fire, but maybe one of you guys can kind of give us a quick synopsis of where we left off, what's happened so far.
I mean, everything you expected, right? He got in the robot. They killed some dinosaurs. It was pretty cool. And then
those fights are pretty red.
Continues to have, you know, character drama that isn't particularly interesting.
Yeah, like what we talked about last time has kind of held true. The characters are not amazing. They're not even good. The directing and the composition is fantastic. You know, the show is amazingly well shot and directed. It's a really great looking show. The robots are cool. You know, they have fun gimmicks that I would hope to see more of in the future. But just as a cohesive whole, it's just not coming together.
What I'll say is I love this kind of weird post-apocalyptic huge conspiracy theory stuff. You know, like I love Ava. I'm a big fan of Eureka 7, all that kind of stuff. And there are vague, weird hints that there's something worthwhile happening here, but it's not enough to distract from how kind of bad the day-to-day stuff is. Like, I appreciate they're trying, and the characters, they at least have a nice large cast with some diverse character types.
Do they?
But
that's my problem. Like, that's my problem with Frank's is, yes, we have a large cast, but it's a large cast that's not doing that much.
Well, that's what I was going to get to, which is that so much of the character story and character development is told through just the most base cliche possible, you know.
It's so predictable.
Yeah, I mean, like, and it does the cardinal sin for me of making you... The plot tells you you must sympathize with the main characters, who are just the most unlikable people on the planet. Like, I get that Zero Two is meant to be everybody's waifu now, but she's a really, really bad, horrible, uninteresting character who's mostly just there to vamp it up for the fans. And, like, Hiro himself is blanker than blank. You know, like, if you told me he was some visual novel protagonist, I absolutely would have believed you in a second, because he has no realistic or interesting personality traits.
Right.
And everything they're doing is like, this was a major problem that robot shows had, like, at the beginning of the 2000s, which is this show just feels like it's put together out of pieces of other shows, mostly Evangelion, which, you know, it's not acceptable 22 years after that show for you to be able to say, oh, it's Ava, but... And I'm not making that as like a flippant comment either, because it very clearly ticks a lot of those boxes. You know, the weird post-apocalyptic setting, the robots that can only be piloted by the chosen children. And it just does everything with so little tact. You know, the Freudian undertones, which are barely undertones at all, you know, it's a giant phallus looking at you directly out of the screen. It's so unsubtle and so degrading, and so I feel bad when I watch this show. You know, I feel like I need to take a shower afterwards. And
I probably wouldn't go that far, but I broadly agree that it's
a mess.
It's a show that
it's a mess. Yeah,
I wish it leaned into that mess part more. You know, I keep repeating myself, but you know, again, this is a show that I think would have been in better hands in, you know, maybe a studio like Trigger, where they would have just leaned into the crass audacity of it instead of like trying to tiptoe around it and like pretend that they're talking about like some deep meaningful message when there's clearly none to be had.
I mean, you say that, but this is partially Trigger's show as well. You know, you cannot abdicate them of responsibility from this. It is their contribution is
yes is I'm apparent. Not right, but also but my argument is that Trigger would not have written a show with characters this like undefined.
Well, we
hate
the writer.
Like, I'm not to say Trigger. Like, I'm not saying every Trigger character is like some like fantastically written character, but they are all given such like given such extreme personalities that they can't help but be memorable. You know, whether for good or ill. Whereas so many of Frank's characters can be boiled down to just the most basic archetypes.
We talked a little bit earlier about how Garo is very good at embracing its inherent silliness, and by doing that, it sort of transcends its very base origins. And this is almost exactly the opposite. It takes itself so seriously. Yes. So
that's my problem
serious.
Which Sane's just like, that, yeah, that is, when he's in the robot, that, he's like, oh, I'm so deep inside of you. And we're trying to play this like, as like serious like character moment
right.
when it's so, so stupid.
Yeah, like there's just...
Like, that's the thing, like even Kill la Kill was not A, as in your face about it, but also B, took itself way less seriously.
Kill la Kill is a cartoon strip, you know? It is a very silly, dumb show with not really that many...
And that's what Frank's should have been, I think, because clearly Frank's can't handle, like, tackling anything more nuanced, you know?
I mean, my counter-argument to that would be there are so many good, stupid robot shows already. Like... The genre should really be evolving beyond that at this point, you know. And for a while it did, and I understand. I absolutely think the show should take itself less seriously, but I kind of don't want it just to devolve into a complete throwback super robot show either. You know, I feel like I said, there are glimpses of occasional weird, interesting crap happening. And I'm a sucker for these big world conspiracy stories, you know, and there's something, you know. We were saying before the podcast started that it reminds us all a lot of Kiznaiva, which also had that good idea, that interesting concept at its heart, and then just sort of squandered it through extremely bad execution. And I feel quite similar about this.
I agree with you for the most part, Zig. I think for me with Franks, I have this relationship with mecha anime that, like, things like Franks and things like, I mean, look, it's even things like Gundam, right? Where I want Gundam to tell good anti-war stories, but I have so little faith in anime and specifically mecha anime to be able to handle those kinds of stories that my stance is, if you can't even pull off that kind of story, then you might as well just do something much more base and simple. It's the reason why a show like Gundam Build Fighters works, is because it's not even trying to tackle the heady concepts that Gundam often tries to take on and fails miserably at. And for me, I kind of feel that way about Franks. Like, I totally see what they're trying to do, but I have so little confidence in their ability to pull it off that, as far as I'm concerned, there is no shame in a show that is simple but well executed. And, you know, I am much more likely to lambast Franks for trying to be something more than it can probably realistically achieve.
I think I'm with Zig in that I think it's okay to have that higher standard, and, you know, it is possible to do a serious mecha show, and I understand that often fails in the post-Evangelion world, but, you know, I think it's fair to want something like that. And
sure, totally.
And you know, obviously Franks is failing at it, and you can't really pull that off if you're piloting your robots by doing it doggy style, as we discussed last time. So, like, Zig did not get the comment on that, so maybe we'll give his feelings on that. But, you know, obviously there's a way to do a serious mecha show, is my point, and we don't get to see it often. And I think it's fair to want that. It's just, you know, we don't get it very often. Go ahead, Zig.
I mean, the thing I will say is that every time the show does anything remotely interesting or good, all you have to say is, yeah, but it has butt paddles. And like, but it's a fundamental problem, right? It destroys any sort of credibility the show has. You know, it says to the viewer, you know, this is a crass, unapologetically male-focused show where the women are effectively means to an end. And I don't think that's even particularly funny in this day and age. You know, in a day and age where anime is increasingly a worldwide concern with a worldwide audience, you know, it's not acceptable to just have something which is, oh, it's anime, you know how crazy those Japanese people are. No, it's just not very cool. You know, it's right. stupid and it's gross and it makes me not want to be interested in anything good the show might do, because no matter what it does, you're still talking about piloting robots by fucking people, and that is fundamentally stupid.
That's what we talk about. That's what we mean when we talk about the show feeling like it's from 10 or 15 years ago, right? Like, that doesn't fly now in a way that I might have in 2004.
It feels like the kind of super edgy thing that you might have proposed, again, in like an immediately post-Evangelion world in the late 90s and early 2000s. You know, and it's another example of the show's incredible clumsiness. Like, you want to make a comment about gender, you want to make a comment about Freud, you know, you want to establish that there's some sort of weird kind of like something fucked up with like sex and love and relationships in this world, but you're using a sledgehammer to smash a walnut. You know, it's so in your face and gross, and I don't know, maybe the studios just think that the people who watch anime are incredibly stupid and require a visual metaphor. I really think it does, I also bet that it doesn't hurt that, like, yo, we can put these teenagers' asses on display all the time and make you feel like you're piloting these women and
Again, like, that's the thing. I totally agree that I want mecha anime to be better and to be able to tell better stories. I mean, look, I have been hoping that Gundam might one day do another, you know, 0080. You know, like, I would love for mecha to be able to tackle those kinds of topics again and do it in ways that are, you know, nuanced and respectful and well told. I guess I'm just trying to be pragmatic here, and I look at what mecha anime is these days, and, you know, I just have zero confidence in their ability to handle those topics, which is why I'm of the mind that this show would be better if it was just, you know, a dumb, crass thing that had nothing to say, because the alternative, you know, what it's doing right now is in many ways, I think, far more worse and offensive, you know?
Yeah, you basically can't have it both ways is what it comes down to. Either you have your ridiculous, campy, whatever, with, you know, training robots with butts in them, or and to be fair, the way, I don't think the piloting system in this show is acceptable in any circumstances, so I'll just throw that out there. But in general, the idea of, you know, having that kind of silly, ridiculous super robot thing on one side, or, you know, taking your story seriously and taking the time to craft it with the nuance that it deserves, you got to do one or the other. You can't be stuck in the middle, and either through intentionally or I think through incompetence, which I think is the case with Frank's, it's just not going to work. I think that's what it comes down to.
I would agree. Like,
I kind of disagree, because and I hate to bring it up because it's the one that everyone goes to, but Gurren Lagann kind of managed to do that, you know, and it kind of managed to be, you know, it started as a super silly, super camp attempt to kind of like revive the super robot genre and sort of evolved into a genuine character story. And I'm not saying that Gurren Lagann was like the most well-told or well-developed character story ever, you know, but it managed to tell an emotionally affecting story with good, simple, clean character archetypes and a few twists along the way, you know. And it's debatable whether you can do that trick twice, because so much of that show was bound up in the idea that it was like a revival of Mazinger and all that stuff. But I think it's possible to make a show that is both stupid and smart, you know. And I think Kill la Kill was perhaps not at the same level of Gurren Lagann, but it definitely captured some of that magic of, we're doing this thing very stupidly, but taking it seriously enough that our characters and
Totally.
I mean, story that's why all eyes are on Promare and not on Frank.
Yeah, right. But that's the thing, right? I love Gurren Lagann. I love Kill la Kill, but I think there actually is an academic difference between those and, you know, something like, you know, the show Franks is trying to be. And what I mean by that is, like, yes, Gurren Lagann does tell like a very effective, compelling character story, but I think the difference here is that is that I'm not trying to say like Gurren Lagann succeeded on being crass and over the top, you know, because its heartfelt moments really do land. But I also think it benefits from telling a story that is fairly straightforward. Like Gurren Lagann isn't trying to say anything about, you know, gender or society or life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or I mean, it is, but it's those stories. It kind of is, but you know, its messages are very broad. You know, it's not trying to tackle a specific topic.
They are themes that bubble through the character work rather than ones that are they're subtext rather than text, basically.
Yes, yes, and I think that's why I personally make that difference between something like Gurren Lagann and, you know, whatever the fuck Franks is trying to be.
I mean, Franks wants you know, to be like, Evangelion. It so desperately wants to be Evangelion. It worships at the fount of that show. And again, that feels so out of place in the year 2018.
Yeah. And even then, even if it really does, then I think it's probably missing some of those messages because, you know, say what you will about, you know, Evangelion, but like its characters are well-defined and memorable and have strong identifiable personalities, which I think goes a long way to helping it, you know, versus Franks's characters, which, you know, again, they feel paint by numbers, you know, they feel designed by committee.
I mean, Hero is very much the modern archetype of the anime hero, which is like the stoic, silent type who...
Nobody.
Yeah, you know, like...
That's a problem. Is he just, you know, like... just doesn't have anything interesting to say, you know? I mean,
nobody has anything interesting to say in this show, really, but...
Like, the problem is that, because the problem is that even when Hero is given a chance to say something, all he just says is, you know, I want to get in the robot, and it's like, we're never told why he wants to get into the robot, or, like, what that says about who he is as a person, you know? He just keeps repeating over and over again, I gotta get in the robot.
I mean, add some metaphor about wings or some shit.
I feel like there's a story to be told there about how, since it's implied that the parasites are brought up from birth to do this thing, there's a story to be told there about how he feels like piloting the robot is the only thing worthwhile he can do. But the show
isn't
very
established by the show. Yeah.
Exactly. The show is very bad at communicating that idea, you know, and it sort of just comes off that he wants to pilot the robot to be as cool and awesome as everyone else, which is to say not very. But
it's a thing I go into a bit in the last podcast we had about Franks, but if the show leaned more heavily into the apocalyptic aspect of it, you know, if it leaned more heavily into the aspect of like, hey kids, you know, if you can't pilot these robots, you're going to the factories or something, you know, you're going to the camps, you know, if their identity and their purpose was tied to piloting a robot, then Hero's conflict makes a whole lot more sense, because not only is it wanting to be useful, it's also not wanting to be, you know, shipped off to some black site facility or whatever.
But again, at that point, you're basically telling the Shinji Ikari story, except that was told 20 years ago and much more effectively. You know,
sure, but at least it would give the show something to work with.
There's just a fundamental lack of imagination to Franks. You know, it feels... Again, it feels like a Franken show made out of the... Like
a
someone
Franken
tried
to... show.
Oh.
That's it. This podcast
That's it,
is
we're done.
Over. Yeah. No, you ruined it.
Yeah.
Oh no.
I don't even know what we were talking about.
It. That's over. It's over.
Now's a good time to chime in. Written by the guy who wrote Plastic Memories. We're talking.
We were talking about
making a Franken show out of parts of other ideas and not a single original bone in their body. That is, I think, ultimately, once again, the source of all of Franks's problems, if we can conveniently pin it on one person.
Also, a show that traded incredibly heavily on like the most blatant, simplistic emotional manipulation possible. Like another show which wanted to be about big ideas was really the most small time thing you could possibly imagine. And that's the way I feel about Franks as well. It feels small, unambitious, uninteresting, despite everything, despite the collaborating studios, despite the not inconsiderable amount of production time and money that's been invested, I would hazard a guess, despite some very nice directing and scene blocking and all that stuff, you know, it feels small time. It feels like something we've seen 1,000 times before.
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that's a good spot to call it a day there. And we think we covered pretty much everything we were expecting to cover there. We've got plenty of other shows that we're watching, of course, and we'll probably talk about them on another podcast. I don't know if we're going to have one next week because I'm going to be away, but we'll talk about that later. You guys have any closing thoughts, final shout outs you want to give to anything we maybe didn't talk about? Or
I do want to shout out something which is coming up, which is this weekend. A new Super Sentai show is beginning. It is Lupin Ranger versus Pat Ranger. And so Iroh and Aquagaze and I and anybody else who watches, we will have some thoughts up on that in the new week.
We may potentially do a podcast about that.
Quite possibly, yes.
Coming soon.
There will also be a wrap-up post on the current Super Sentai Q Ranger, which will also probably make an appearance at some point next week.
Awesome. Get back on that coverage of
on that spandex
the Toku train,
men in rubber suits punching other men in rubber suits while things explode in the background or whatever the
that continues to happen. Surprisingly,
official tag is there.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's cool. Anybody got anything else? I'll just give a quick shout out to Digashikashi, which I also want to talk about at some point. But
is it still going?
It is. Season 2 has been quite good. It's actually making me wish that they didn't go to the half-length episodes, but you know, we can save that discussion for another day. So,
sure, put it on the board.
I guess I'll give a quick shout out if we're talking to like about, you know, just these mid-tier shows that are just keep on going but aren't, you know, eliciting either endless praise or endless rage, but I'm still watching Kokoku. That's
I want to catch up on that.
Been an interesting urban fantasy story so far. Again, I feel like it's still kind of trading on the potential of, you know, it's the power of the mundane fear rather than, you know, making good on it. But I think it's doing just enough interesting things with its premise that at this point, I'm probably in it for the long haul. I don't know. Pop Team Epic is still going. You know, it's the best animation posting nightmare of the season. I think that's it for me. So.
Yeah, I'll shout out good old standby Pokemon Sun and Moon. Shit's still going.
Still running.
I know y'all still watched Pokemon somehow. 20 years ago, but it's still going. It's still not bad.
Yeah, I just realized this week when Iroh told me that I did not realize the Pokemon anime has been going nonstop since the beginning of Pokemon.
Last time went on like a major hiatus was the Porygon incident.
The only time, in fact.
Indeed.
Really?
The only time. The episode which just aired a couple of days ago was episode 1000, if you're only counting televised episodes. So they are still rolling.
Jeez.
Still rolling.
It's the reason why all your flashy anime special effects are kind of grayed out when you're watching them. Yeah. So thanks, Porygon.
Fucking thanks, Pokemon.
Thanks, Pokemon. Yeah.
Forcing me to
do it. I mean, everybody blames Porygon, but it was actually Pikachu who did it. So what I'm saying is we should ban Pikachu.
Yes.
Here.
Get behind that. Pikachu.
It's his fault. All right, guys. So a little bit of housekeeping to wrap things up. You can read everything we write about anime at theglorioblog.com. Chances are you probably found this podcast there, but just in case, that is where you can find all of our other content. You can also follow us on Twitter at theglorioblog. Probably the best way to get all of our updates on when posts come out. Also, very rarely I post funny anime photoshops on there, which I have not done in a while. I did one a couple weeks ago, like a week or two ago. But so you can check us out there. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe, leave us a review,
tell your friends,
rating, whatever, tell your friends. I don't know how podcasting works yet. We're still working on that.
Leave a 5-star review. It's not that hard.
Yeah, just click the 5th star there. Do us a favor.
You don't even got to say anything.
Yeah. Just Yeah, so
get
that
those
would
metrics up.
Yeah, get those metrics up. That would be helpful. You know, we are trying to work our way through this and get better at podcasting here. So, you know, any feedback or whatever, please feel free. Hit us up on, you know, our, on the site or on Twitter, wherever. And that's gonna do it. So thanks again, guys, for joining in.
Thank you.
And we will catch everybody next time.